Interview with Flight Lieutenant John Wood, recorded at RAF Lynham by Rodney Giesler on March 28, 1994.
Flight Lieutenant Wood, could you tell me when you were born?
Certainly, 12th of August, 1941.
And how did you come to join the Royal Air Force?
Well, being a war baby, many of my relations had been servicemen during the war, and I grew up with the environment of seeing them coming back and telling war stories. Also, another relation of mine worked with Doughty Rotel, and when I was a young teenager, he took me flying in an old Auster and allowed me to have a go. And from there on in, there was only one career.
When did you actually join up?
I joined in 1961 as a direct entry sergeant signaller and went through the signals training and eventually ended up on 38th Squadron Colonial Policing Squadron in Malta.
So you started where, at Compton Bassett, did you?
No, I started at Bridgnorth on the square brush and then went through originally Hullavington and then the schools changed over. The electronic school went to Topcliffe and the navigation school came from Topcliffe to Hullavington, straight swap. And I finished my training at Topcliffe before going on to Maritime.
And you trained initially, what, on varsities and things like that?
Varsities, first of all, yes. And then, in fact, as a signaller, completely on varsities. And then through to the Maritime conversion on Shackleton Mark 1s. And then out to 38th Squadron on Shackleton Mark 2s.
And that was where? St Devil, was it?
No, that was in Malta.
In Malta?
Yeah.
And that would have been when, about?
I joined the squadron in June 1963 and straight into normal squadron training, and the first operation I saw was the 1964 Cyprus emergency when we were called out on the 27th, in fact it was 1963, the 27th of December, straight out the Christmas festivities to go and intercept the Turkish Navy which was coming out to invade Cyprus. And we got there when the Turkish fleet were about 4 or 5 miles off the coast of Cyprus. And by our arrival and that of the Canberras from Malta and Cyprus, we turned the fleet back and the potential invasion of 63-64 was thus avoided.
Because what was the political situation in Cyprus? Was it divided then?
No. It was the end of, hadn't long become independent, and the Turkish rule under Makarios was beginning to become quite heavy, the Greek rule under Makarios was beginning to get quite heavy, and especially with the Turks, and the Turks were already beginning to feel that they were being subjugated, and they were asking for assistance from Turkey.
Now, when the fleet turned back, I mean, what sanctions was Britain able to apply in those days? Would it have sent the Royal Navy over?
We set up a barrier between Turkey, Greece, and Cyprus, and in fact, we maintained it for 9 months with a squadron of round-the-clock air patrols along the north coast of Cyprus and out into the Aegean Sea. The Royal Navy had picket ships positioned strategically as well, and certainly until we were called out of there to go elsewhere in September 64, it was a non-stop watch. But by that stage, the threat was well gone.
And you were based at Akrotiri at this time, were you?
Yes, we moved from Malta across to detach at Akrotiri, then Nicosia, then back to Akrotiri, and we finally finished from Akrotiri.
So when you finished that little job, where did you go to next?
We went to the Middle East, mainly exercising around the Sharjah area, and then we were called into Salalah to support the old Sultan of Oman against the Iraqis who were trying to foment a revolution. And specifically, we were sent out there to search for desert wagons with Bofors guns on, which we knew had left Iraq to drive down through Saudi Arabia and around to Oman.
And they were supporting the South Yemenis, weren't they?
It was the South Yemenis and a general fomentation of Arab revolutionary powers in that area against the old Sultan, who was not famed for his generous nature. And we worked with the Sultan of Oman's Air Force and the Dofa Regiment to find and destroy these desert wagons.
And you were based at Salalah then?
Yes, mm. Yeah.
And flying Shackleton's still?
That was still Shackleton's, yeah. Mm. Yeah. And then from Salalah, we record out of there, and the crew that I was with were actually positioned in Aden to go to Mujunga to set up the Bearer oil patrols. And
Aden was still a British colony then, wasn't
it? It was indeed, yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And our instructions were, as we report out of Salalah, was to go to Aden, and if our relief aircraft from Malta did not arrive serviceable, we were to go to Mujunga. If they arrived serviceable, they were to go to Mujunga, and we were to go back to Malta. Unfortunately, they arrived serviceable. Otherwise, I would have been on the first aircraft into Mujunga as well.
Mujunga was actually where?
It was a city in the north of Malagasy, or Madagascar, whichever it's called at this time.
So it was still the sanctions against the Smiths?
That's right. They had declared UDI a few months before. And we were again the closest colonial policing squadron that with aircraft available.
So you stayed at Aden instead, did you?
We stayed at Aden until our other aircraft came through. They went on to Mujunga, and we were already returning to Malta. That was our base, so we went back to Malta, and from there that was the end of my tour. Mm-hmm. A very interesting tour.
And that was how long?
3 years.
3 years.
Yeah.
Now, did you carry any special equipment? I mean, bearing in mind that Shackleton's a maritime reconnaissance aircraft and is mainly equipped with sonar buoys and depth charges and things like that, presumably you had to change your munitions a bit when you were looking out for these Bofors guns on trucks and so on.
No, crazily enough, the Shackleton was armed with twin 30mm Adens, but we weren't allowed to carry ours because we had to overfly Egypt. And Egypt would not allow us to take our guns across Egypt. And there were no guns available at Aden to fit our aircraft. So although we had the capacity to arm ourselves, we never did. So we were flying...
Empty turrets.
Yeah, we were flying totally unarmed against desert wagons with Bofors guns.
But you had tactical bombers of some sort?
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all?
No.
You just recognized it and passed back information to
That's
the
right. Yeah, the Sultan of Oman's Air Force, who were then flying Piston Provost, but they were rocket equipped. And in fact, we found one desert wagon which had broken down in the desert. We weren't sure whether the crew were still with it, but we caught out the SOAF. And they came in with their rockets and machine guns and destroyed the desert wagon.
Because they had strike masters eventually, didn't they, as well?
Eventually, yes, but that was a long time later.
Yeah. And when you were based in Salalah, you had your own camp, presumably your own mess and everything?
Well, Salalah was a British detachment anyway in those days. We had detachments, we had a base at Kamaxer, and then we had detachments at Riyadh, Salalah, Sharjah. Well, Sharjah was a base as well. We had quite a presence in the Middle East in those days.
So you came back to Malta at the end of your tour, then what?
Came back to Malta, came back home to go on to Air Sea Rescue as a winchman. And during my disembarkation leave, I received notification that I was to go to Biggin Hill for pilot selection. Went to Biggin Hill in August 1966. Then went off to do the Air Sea Rescue course. Went through the course, and I was about 2 weeks off the end of the course when I heard that I had been selected for pilot training. Carried on with the course, went to Lucas as an Air Sea Rescue winchman.
On helicopters.
On helicopters, on whirlwinds. And then at the end, eventually in April the following year, went through for commissioning.
Had you asked to go change over to her?
Yes.
Pilot training?
Yeah, the whole desire was to be a pilot right from the word go. Mm-hmm. And whilst I failed to become a pilot on the initial selection at Hornchurch in those days. I applied immediately. I joined 38 Squadron for crossover training.
So you were, your application was successful.
That's right. Yeah.
And you went off for ab initio training. Were up to Linton on it or something?
No, I went initially to Church Fenton. Well, I went through the Cessernia, which was the aircrew officers training school, and then to Church Fenton for primary flying on Chipmunks, and then I went to the Sarston, which was a beautiful airbase. Really never could understand why they closed it down as a training centre. And trained at Sarston. Left Sarston to go on to advanced training onto varsities at Oakington. Out of Oakington, hit the long holds, which were current then and are back in vogue now. Held for a year with CFS. Hold. Between flying training and going to squadrons.
Really? Yeah.
As we know, it's the same situation pertains now. Mainly because of the numbers of recruits coming through, the change of aircraft types that was going on in the Air Force at the time. And because a 1 year between finishing advanced flying training and going to a squadron or to an OCU, I held with Central Flying School at Little Risington for a year as their flying wing adjutant. Which was very interesting, lots of interesting things to do. And of course, because it was Central Flying School, I was able to get a lot of flying as well.
Because the Red Arrows were based there then, weren't they?
They were based there, but they were actually based at Kemble, but they were parented by Little Risington. So I was involved with a lot of their work.
Going back to your remark about Syston, you said it was a nice base. In what way? What were the features of it?
Well, it was a very private airfield. And still is, of course. In fact, at one stage, Ford's tried to buy it as a car testing centre because it is almost impossible to see onto the airfield. It's right alongside the A46, but the main airfield is tucked around the corner of the station buildings. So it's very quiet. And River Trent runs the other side of it, and the other side of that was a monastery. So it was very difficult to see into the base. So it was a very private little airfield. Very centrally situated, of course, just south of Newark. And also, from the flying training point of view, it was away from most of the major configurations of other aircraft. It also had two or three good disused airfields nearby, so that whilst we were doing aerobatic training, for instance, we used to go above a disused airfield. So if anything went wrong, we had a runway of sorts to put down on. Very handy for the Derbyshire Hills for low-level flying. And away from everyone else. And it also had a very good weather factor. But, unfortunately...
I was working around there in Nottingham for one time, and I remember, you know, the only trace of Syston was I think I had jet props.
That's right.
Going in and out. You presumably after Chipmunks went on to Jet Province.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's because how has it worked out? You did your first solo on Chipmunks, I suppose, did you? And then you went on to advanced flying training on Jet Province.
Well, you did primary flying training on Chipmunks up to solo standard, about 25 to 30 hours, and then to Sarston, or to one of the jet stations, where again. After about 8 hours, you went solo, and then, of course, you went into advanced flying, formation, low level, aerobatics, instrument flying, all the way through to graduation, where, again, slight change from then to now, but at the end of the Sarston course, we were granted our wings. Then we went from there to whatever advanced flying was intended, whether it was fighters, which would have been in those days Lightnings, Hunters,
Buccaneers,
yes, I think they were in.
The Navy, weren't they?
That's right. And, or heavy, if you're going towards the heavy world of Transport Command or the Coastal Command, then you go off to Oakington to do varsity flying. Or, of course, if you go in helicopters, then you went off to Turnhill to do the helicopter training. I elected for heavies. and went from there to Wilkington.
I'm interested because I got my PPL on a chipmunk at Denham in the LA, way back. And that to me was a lovely aircraft for a student to fly. It was very secure. You made you feel very secure. And the fact you had to really fight it into a spin.
Yes.
Now, I've often wondered what it was like then stepping out of a chipmunk cockpit and going into a jet. What were the main differences? Because you didn't take long to sail on the Province, did you?
No, about 7 hours. Mm. The big difference is the jets were a lot easier to fly. You didn't have the torque problems of the chipmunk. Every time you moved the power, you had to change the rudders, and you had to keep an eye on the props. Because with the jet, none of those problems were there. There were no rudder problems at all. In fact, you could effectively, unless you were going to spin or do aerobatics, you could actually fly without ever using the rudders. Pretty airplane to fly, the jet Provost. Big visibility, very easy, of course, especially as a nosewheel aircraft as opposed to the chipmunk's tailwheel. You had very good visibility nearer to the ground.
And of taxiing, of course.
That's right, you didn't have to weave. The biggest single difference against the jet compared to the chipmunk was that if you wanted power, you had to think about it. Because, especially on the Mark III, move the throttles, and a finite time later, the power came in. Whereas on the chipmunk and any other prop aircraft, you move the power and you instantly got response. So there was a time delay, and it used to catch people out initially.
So you never did a gliding approach like you did in the chipmunk. You had to come on with a certain amount of power in case you wanted to overshoot.
It was always advisable. If you were coming on the glide with a Mark III, if you'd got hot and high and you were gliding, you almost had to be committed to landing. You could get away with it, but it depended on when you put the power on.
So, and from Jet Provost, you went on to Varsities, did you?
That's right, yeah.
The twin engine as well as large.
Yeah, twin engine first, just to get used to flying asymmetric. And of course, in those days, asymmetric training was a lot more serious. We used to shut engines down at incredibly early stages of flight and survive.
But it was a fairly safe aircraft to fly, really, was it?
Yes, it was, really. Varsity was a beautiful airplane. It was quite a forgiving aircraft. It was a very stable airplane, and it was a nice airplane to fly, very comfortable. But the step up from a little jet Provost to quite a large lumbering aircraft like the Varsity was quite pronounced.
And of course its ancestor was the Wellington Bomber, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. direct descendant. In fact, the Varsity was built as the replacement, as a bomber originally. And certainly on pilot training, the aircraft we had were the early bombers. The bomb bay was just sealed up, still had the bomb aimers positions in, and hadn't been modified to any extent as the aircraft at Nav School or the electronic school had been.
And tricycle undercarriage, of course, as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So how long did you have to do on varsities before you got your qualification?
About 5 months for the advanced flying course, which included at least one overseas flight.
So that was sort of long haul as well as, did you do low-level technical and stuff?
No. No, it was just basically instrument flying, procedural flying, and then overseas procedural flying, just to qualify the young pilot to move on to transport command or coastal command.
And when you qualified on that, presumably you were then posted to an OCU, were you?
Yes.
On Hercules then?
Yes, I was posted to Hercules, but as I said, 1 year. In fact, 14 months after I finished the course.
Were you able to keep yourself current during that time?
Well, yes, because I went to Central Flying School with the three types, chipmunk, jet provost and varsity, I was able to stay current very, very nicely, and in fact flew all the aircraft. And I had the delight of flying the jet provost 5 on acceptance tests. with the CFS instructor, whose task it was to actually accept the jet provost into service. He would often give me the chance to take a brand new aircraft up on what was virtually his maiden flight in the Royal Air Force, with him sitting in the seat taking all the notes that he needed to, and then allowing me to do the flying.
That had, what, just an uprated Viper in it, or more than that?
It was the same engine as the Mark IV jet provost, but it had pressurization, and it got rid of the tip tanks. Slightly different shape aircraft to the 3 and the 4. Again, a nice airplane to fly, lovely and comfortable, but it hadn't quite got the power or response of the Mark IV.
Did you have a flight in a nap as they were there?
No, I didn't, strange enough. I had a chance to fly with the Red Arrows on a couple of their practices, but fighters were never really my scene, and so I didn't take the opportunity up. Sometimes I regret it, because it would have been nice to have said that I'd flown with the Red Arrows, but...
Were you just temperamentally unsuited to fighters, or didn't high speed appeal to you?
The role didn't appeal to me. Mm-hmm. I preferred the comfort, really, of a big aircraft. I think had I gone straight into fighter training when I first went into the Air Force, then there would have been no thought about it, because that was originally what I wanted to do, was fly fighters. But having had a tour on Shackletons and a part tour on helicopters, and got used to the crew environment, I didn't really want to go back into single-seaters. I enjoyed flying with the crew.
So... when you joined the Hercules OCU, where were they based?
The Hercules OCU originally was based at Thorney Island.
Yeah.
That was back in 1970. And I did the OCU down there, which was, again, about 5 months. And I came here to 24 Squadron for my first co-pilot's tour.
That was in the 60s, wasn't it?
That was early 70s. It was when they, in fact, 24 Squadron lost two aircraft with the Pisa crash and the Tromso crash.
Really?
Yeah.
They were low-level crashes? Or?
Well, I know. Pisa was effectively a low-level night formation crash where something went wrong and the aircraft hit the sea and killed the crew and 47 Italian paratroopers, which is rather tragic. The Tromso crash was more a mishandling situation on ice in Norway, and the aircraft just skidded off the runway into a ditch. The aircraft broke up, but no one was seriously injured.
So, when you were sort of training as a co-pilot on Hercules, you were doing a mixture of everything.
In those days, yes.
Route flying and tactical.
Yes. Yeah. In the early days, everyone did everything. It was just route flying and tactical flying, but there was no split in the force. It didn't matter. Six squadrons then. All six squadrons did the same sort of thing.
What parts of the Europe and the world? I suppose all over the place you went.
Yeah. The Hercules force has always been, from that point of view, very lucky. Really, we go anywhere, wherever the situation was. And in those days, we were still talking to South Africa. So we used to do a regular routine run down around through South Africa, out to the Far East, of course, because we still had Changi. So we had a lot of trade out to the Far East. America, of course, which has always been a regular run for us. And even to on that particular tour, even into the very north of Greenland, up to Thule, which was quite interesting to be that far north.
Can you recall any flights that gave you particular pleasure or gave you a particular challenge out of the ordinary?
Yes, I suppose two out of at that time would strike home. The first one was that we did a run down to Malawi. The governments had agreed that the Royal Engineers, as a training task, would build a road in Malawi. And we were sent down to Malawi to support them. We went to Blantyre as our base camp, where we were meeting the Britannias who were bringing the major equipment in. Then we would take it to a small place called Isuzu, up in the mountains. We had to fly down Lake Malawi and then up through a valley, because often in the mornings it was foggy. And we had to go up underneath the fog, basically, up through a valley, out almost to the... Would it be the Zambian border? Or Zaire border? Whatever country.
They meet there.
Right out to the, almost out to the border, anyway. And then come back and fly up the escarpment to Isuzu. And Isuzu was a grass strip, which had been checked out for us to use. And we landed there. The largest aircraft I think they'd seen before we ever arrived was a small twin engine. So this then very large Hercules arrived to great interest. The captain, who was in the kind of normal way with the fleet, invited the locals to have a look around. And the first time we went in, it was really just the local white people who'd come out to greet us. The next time we went in there, there were a few natives who wanted to have a look. So we obviously let them have a look as well. And they were all terribly impressed with this big airplane. The third time, there are a lot more. And the fourth time we went in, we thought the whole of Africa had turned up. And the only way that we could get people through was to open both sides, the front door and the rear door, and actually just walk them through. We could do, literally, show them nothing else. The numbers of people were phenomenal. They all thought it was absolutely marvelous. They really didn't see very much except the inside of the back end of a Hercules. But they enjoyed it. And that was a lovely short spell. The other trip would have been the trip to Thule in Greenland. We came out of Lynham to go up to Greenland. And on the way to Thule, we were tasked with dropping supplies for a Cambridge University expedition in a fjord. We again descended underneath the cloud, went into the fjord, which was absolutely breathtaking scenery, dropped to the expedition and carried on up to Thule, which is the furthest north that I've ever been. I'm not sure whether it's the furthest base in the Northern Hemisphere, but with their huge radars. And of course, we had the chance there to have a look at the radars, to see the capability of this huge radar, and also to look at the local scenery, as we were there in the summer. And then we went from there to Goose Bay, coming through from the north. We actually flew over the magnetic North Pole, which for an aviator's point of view is quite interesting. It was to be flying south with all the magnetic equipment showing that you were north is quite interesting. And then over the magnetic North Pole itself, of course, the compasses just go haywire. And then on down to Goose Bay, to arrive at Goose Bay in the middle of the London-Vancouver air race. And so the approach into Goose Bay was interesting, to say the least. So a very interesting little trip. Really, the end of a very nice trip, other than obviously than the return home. But those were the two most spectacular sorties of that tour.
But most of your trips, I suppose, were of a military nature, in the sense you were supporting forces overseas or whatever. Flying supplies or personnel.
Even more so in those days.
Yeah. And to Germany as well, of course.
Yes. Germany has always been the bread and butter run for the Hercules force.
Now, up to this time, presumably, you would have been doing peacetime flying.
Yes.
Of course, the Falklands War changed everything in the sense that you were on wartime operations. Obviously, there's more than 4 minutes to talk about, but perhaps you could just tell me your experience of when the war broke out and you were sent south.
Well, it's very interesting from my point of view, because I'd just come back into the Royal Air Force, having retired at 38. And I'd been trawled back. and I just got back onto the squadron, and I'd
were
been.
Were you a reservist then?
I was back full time, but I'd gone out of the Air Force for a year, and I'd been back on the squadron for about 5 months, when the Falklands crisis blew up, and they just called people in. Basically on an experience level, and sent them off. And we went down to Gibraltar, loaded really to the gunwales with equipment, to wait at Gibraltar until they decided which way we were going to go on down to Ascension Island.